Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. And this, we call it the Let's Be Honest show. It turns out that one of our alert listeners pointed out that Rick Phillips has a problem with Let's Be Honest. He says it too much. And not wishing to embarrass Rick or put him in an awkward situation, I decided to title the show Let's Be Honest.
Because that's what you do, right? That is the way that you solve a problem. Let's just hit it head on like a wall. What good can come from this, Tony?
It's good.
Would you like me for one moment to point out anything that you might say over and over and over?
Well, it could be worse. My daughter, my oldest daughter, she was very, very verbal when she was young. She would talk about things, and she would let her feelings be known and so forth. She was a little bit around 2 years older than my son, who didn't talk very much but could hit.
Right.
And so she would you could just see it. She would keep badgering him until he would hit her, and then she would go and tell on him for hitting.
Right.
And we had
how'd that work out for him?
Yeah. Well, he did fine. Because we saw the whole thing
unfold.
So let me
get this right. Am I the one being hit here?
Well, I'm no.
In your analogy,
no,
am I the one getting hit here? Or?
No, because you can't talk, obviously. That's your problem. That's what the alert listener pointed out. So, in fact,
No. The alert listener pointed out I talk too much.
That I'm going to keep badgering you until till something happens.
That's, and then that's the way every time you do this, I'm going to point out something that you do.
Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, and here himself to be honest with you about how to access the web, the manager of communications infrastructure from the University of Kentucky, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. And you realize there is not a snowball's chance in that warm place down below that I'm going to say that word one time during this show, right?
Well, let's be honest.
That's your job. Let's be clear.
Okay. and a new era of Health Matters is born here today.
Oh, my gosh. To get the audio of the shows, I'm not sure why you'd want to. But if you do, go to WMKY.org. That's right, WMKY.org. You can listen to this fiasco over and over again. There is a link there to a podcast. There's a summary in case there's a specific show you think you might want to listen to. But again, it's all found at Morehead State Public Radio's website, WMKY.org. After that, do as our listeners do and join us for a conversation on Facebook. Yes, you can tell us that we annoy you by what we say, not, you know, whoever it was that told Tony whatever they told him. Facebook.com/HM Radio Show is where you interact with us. That's the fan page. And again, Tony and I have been going round and round with the things that we do over and over again, and clearly, I say clearly, too much. So.
Well, this is going to be a very awkward show. There will be long periods of silence while we try to think of new words.
While they edit out the laugh tracks, right? So, you know, we obviously listen to your feedback and your input on Facebook. So if you want to interact with the show, suggest show topics, give feedback, although we do prefer the feedback is about Tony and not about me, jump on Facebook, like that page, and interact with the show. It is your opportunity to be a part of Health Matters. Again, you can find that at facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, let's be honest about why drug prices are so high.
Do you even know why drug prices are so high?
Well, I've got 11 facts, and in our third and final fraction portion, we'll do some solutions.
Do you have an extra toe that we don't know about?
This came from the AMA Journal, and I got it down to 11, but these are some pretty neat facts I just wanted to point out. Fact number one, in 2013, per capita spending, that is for every American, we spent $858 per person for medicines, compared with an average of $400 for 19 other advanced industrialized nations. We are over twice as much spending for prescription drugs as other nations. List prices for our top 20 highest revenue grossing drugs, 3 times greater in the United States than in the United Kingdom. And it's getting worse. Between 2013 and 2015, net spending on prescription drugs increased 20%, and prescription medications are now 17% of total health care costs, 19% of employer-based insurance benefits. Fun fact number two, you remember Sovaldi. We have hit this drug hard and repeatedly. This is the hepatitis C drug. At $84,000 per 12-week course, they actually commissioned a study which said that it was cost-effective. However, in 2014, our state Medicaid program spent an estimated $1.1 billion on Sovaldi, and they had no additions to their budget. So what happened is we drained $1.1 billion, which we have been spending treating diabetes, treating cancer, treating lung disease, treating heart disease, into treating hepatitis C, paying charging $84,000 per course for Sovaldi. Fun fact number three, the primary reason for increasing drug spending is the high price of branded products. Brand name drugs, 10% of all prescriptions, 72% of drug spending. And between 2008 and 2015, 7 years, the cost of these drugs increased 164%, and the consumer price index, same period, increased 12%. Specialty drugs, high-cost drugs, injectable biological medications often exceeds $250,000 per patient. Now, the average disposable income in the U.S. is around $54,000. 5 times your average disposable income to pay for these biologic medications. Fun fact number four, there are also, driving these drug prices, sharp increases in older generic drugs, drugs that we thought we had solved, drugs that were costing pennies a tablet. This is a strategy from entrepreneurs. They buy up a company that has exclusive rights to a drug or is the only company making the drug, and then they just jack the price. Turing Pharmaceuticals bought a drug for treatment of toxoplasmosis, Daraprim, jumped the price from $13 to $750 a pill. Other drugs include 2,500% increase in the price of isoproterenol, 1,700% increase in nitroprusside, 637% increase in the price of digoxin. And finally, this is fact number five, drug prices are higher in the United States than the rest of the industrialized world because, in addition to the brand name problem, we've got the entrepreneurial buying up of people who've cornered of companies that have cornered the market and jacking the prices. We allow manufacturers to set their own price for a given product. In countries with national health insurance systems, a body negotiates the price or it rejects the product if it is, in fact, deemed to be too expensive. We have no checks, no balances, and so these prices are simply laid out there and they are paid because we can't negotiate. That's the first 5 fun facts. We'll give you 6 more in our second fractional portion. We'll talk about some solutions in our third and final fractional portion. Our sponsor, let's be honest, why are drug prices so high? We've got a lung cancer symposium coming up on September 16th here in Moorhead at the Center for Health Education and Research. Starts at 9 a.m., goes 4 p.m. We've talked about it before, but I've got a complete list of the speakers, and I wanted to mention them to you. Angela Brumley Shelton coming in. She is a certified tobacco treatment specialist, the tobacco coordinator at the Lexington Fayette County Health Department. We've got Amanda Fallon Bennett. She is a tobacco control scientist with a focus on tobacco policy. She's going to give us an update on health care policy. Jamie Stutz, been on our program before. He is associate professor at UK in the Department of Behavioral Science and Psychology. He talks about how to discuss lung cancer screening and how to obtain informed consent. Thomas Tucker, associate director for cancer control and senior director of cancer surveillance at the University of Kentucky's Marquee Cancer Center. Anthony Weaver.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. Just he's a hanger-on. He's a not to worry about. Mary Ellen Wooers received her doctorate from University of Maryland, and she is currently faculty emeritus with Ohio State University College of Public Health, talking about tobacco cessation. So we've got smoking policy, tobacco control, tobacco cessation, lung cancer screening, and obtaining consent for lung cancer screening. This is going to be a great seminar. Starts up at 9 a.m., goes to 4 p.m. at the Center for Health Education and Research, September 16th. Visit the AHEC website. Sign up today. I'm really excited about this. This should be a lot of fun working with these excellent speakers. Rick, I got a thing. It's called Bagpipe Lung. Gives you a chance to kind of think about how we take care of patients. This was published August 22nd in the journal Thorax.
Is this something that you have, a constant stream of hot air coming out of your mouth?
Bagpipe Lung. It sounds odd, doesn't it? It sounds like when you breathe, you would be playing some kind of a danceable, you know, ballad of something,
awkward sounding,
yeah,
squeaking.
Well, first thing you need to know is there's something called hypersensitivity pneumonitis. It is an inflammatory lung disease, and your lung, your immune system in your lung, gets sensitized to something, and it leads to chronic inflammation, scarring of the lung, and it will kill you if not controlled. So they had a 61-year-old man referred to their a specialty clinic. This is in Withenshaw, United Kingdom. Comes in April 2014. 7 years he's had this dry cough. He's gotten progressively breathless. They put him on medicines to try to shut down his immune system to keep it from scarring. Hasn't worked. He had CAT scan. They showed scarring of the lungs. They figured he's got this hypersensitivity pneumonitis. So they ask him the usual question. Do you have pets in the house? Do you work in hay where you might be exposed to molds or exposed to anything that might cause your lungs to get irritated and produce this response? And the answer was no. There was one time when he felt better. There was a 3-month period when he went to live in Australia. His breathing rapidly improved. He was able to walk 10 miles on the beach without stopping. As soon as he got back to United Kingdom, his breathing deteriorated rapidly. Now, Rick, if that were you, and you were not able to breathe, and all of a sudden you could walk 10 miles in Australia, would you come back to England?
Yeah, there's a lot of snakes in Australia.
Good point. You gotta take the whole thing.
Yeah, I wouldn't be happy there.
Yeah. Lifelong non-smoker, not taking any medication. As a hobby, and this is where the title came from, he played bagpipes daily. Now, here is a key point. He did not take the bagpipes to Australia. 3-month vacation from the bagpipes.
And people liked him there.
Yeah, I'm sure. That may be it. In fact, he was more popular in Australia because he didn't play the bagpipes. That was possible. They were treating him with steroid medicines, but honestly, Tony,
what do you think of a guy wearing a kilt?
I think they're looking for attention. I mean, you know,
are you going to go up and be buddies with him? Are you going to go up and be nice and talk to him and be all buddy-buddy?
I would talk to him, but I would I would keep my distance. I would ask him questions about their culture and so forth, but I would keep my distance. Is that fair?
Well, I don't think you'd ever make your way up to him. I think they'd have to come to you.
I might take a picture of him or something using telescopic lens.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm just saying. I don't see you. So he had more friends for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
More people liked him.
By September 2014... this guy's got low oxygen levels, and that's really bad news. If you think about it, you could have one lung taken out, and you would still have okay oxygen levels. So he's lost over half his lung capacity at this point. They put him in the hospital with his low oxygen level. They finally, somebody asked him if he had any hobbies, and they figured out he played the bagpipes. This was the first time. Keep in mind, this guy, 7 years, he's had worsening lung function. Somebody asked if he plays the bagpipes. So they culture the bagpipes. They had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 fungi cultured out of his bagpipes. Basically, it was moist in there where he breathed in there through the years, and these things were. This was just a cesspool of fungi. Unfortunately, he deteriorated. He died in 2014. This is the case in the thorax. They point out musical instruments can get nasty on the inside.
Okay.
So one. Musicians should clean out your instruments. And this has been reported with saxophones. There was a trombone player that didn't clean his instrument. And you can basically, if you're breathing through this thing, I mean, you don't usually breathe in through your trombone, but still you put your mouth on it. And if there's a cloud of fungus is there, you're going to get in trouble.
Not sure what to tell you, drummers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we don't have any friends, you know, so you just quit anyway. Speaking of quitting anyway, we're going to come back with our second fractional portion. We're going to take a break first. Why don't you do that as well? Clean out your bagpipes and come back and listen to our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Let's Be Honest show because it turns out that Rick says let's be honest a lot, and we are trying to help him. We're supporting him. We did not want to make this awkward by calling attention to it. I think Rick knows that the radio audience is a supportive group of people that are here to help him with his speech impediment, and so it won't be, you know, it won't be anything awkward, I don't think.
You're going to see awkward in a minute.
Our sponsor, for the second time, let's be honest about why drug prices are so high. And we're going through our 11 facts about the high prices of drugs. We're up to fun fact number 6. There is little evidence of an association between research and development costs and drug prices. Don't buy that stall. In fact, a lot of these things were developed with taxpayer funds, and then the companies raised the prices. In fact, prescription drugs are priced in the U.S. It's very clear, and we've said this before on Health Matters, on the basis of what the market will bear. That market is not necessarily how much will you pay for the drug. It's how much will you tolerate everyone's insurance rising because that drug is so expensive. So we all pay for these drugs, whether we have the disease or not. In fact, number 7, since the advent of the Medicare drug benefit, that was the Medicare Part D in 2006, government entities have paid for 40% of the nation's total retail prescription drug expenditure. 40% comes from the government through Medicare and Medicaid benefits. Fun fact number 8, certain expensive drug products are important clinical breakthroughs, may be relatively cost-effective, but others are merely costly. And it is very difficult for the consumer to tell the difference because the way these things are marketed, it sounds like every one of them is a breakthrough. Number 9, the only form of competition that consistently and substantially decreases prescription drug prices occurs when generic drugs are available. If 2 generic manufacturers are making the drug, the price drops 55% to 55% of where it started, If there are five manufacturers making it, you get down to a third of where it started. And if you have it widely manufactured by 15 different manufacturers, you wind up with a price that is 13% of the original brand price. So very clearly, if we can get drugs off patent reliably and quickly, our prices will come down. Which brings us to fact number 10. Entry of generic drugs going off patent is often delayed. First of all, you can obtain patents on other aspects like the coating, the formulation, the method of administration. Here's a classic example, the purple pill. Prilosec, remember?
Right.
The company that made it, it comes out as two forms. There's a left-handed form and a right-handed form. It turns out that the left-handed form is active, the right-handed form is not. Well, the company patented separating out the left-handed active form. It's no better. It has no difference in side effects. It's not more powerful. It's nothing. But Nexium, in fact, is enjoying a very nice run as a branded drug, despite the fact that it is not in any way different from Prilosec. It's just left-handed Prilosec. Fun fact number 11, in attempting to require formal approval of drugs predating modern new review processes, the FDA said, look, if you will do some research on an old drug, we will pay you for it. And that's what happened to Colchicine. After a six-week study, one manufacturer lawyered up, put everybody making generic Colchicine out of business, and raised the price 5,000%. This is what we all face in our drug costs every day. That is our sponsor. Let's be honest about why drug prices are so high. Third fractional portion, we'll talk about some possible solutions. They would seem obvious, but they require political will. You're going to have to buck some very, very powerful drug companies to get this done. First thing we're going to be honest about is aging is associated with better mental health. This is good news for us old folks. August 25th, published in the August issue of the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, senior author Dilip Jesty. His first name is Dilip, D-I-L-I-P. Now, Dilip, for me, is sort of like the guy wearing a kilt.
Okay.
Do I trust Dilip? Would I engage in a close conversation with Dilip? I will read Dilip's papers.
You
because
would.
He seems bright.
Right.
He is the Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry and Neurosciences at the Director of Center on Healthy Aging at the University of California, San Diego. And he looked at 1,500 people ages 21 to 99 years old living in San Diego. Did some telephone interviews and so forth. Now, keep in mind, this is what we call a cross-sectional study. They did not follow these people for years. They called them up and asked them some questions. Their average age of the people they called, 66 years, half of them men, half women. 60% had a bachelor's degree. 20% had completed 12 years or less of education. Mental health scores. They did a happiness subscale. And this, if you looked at their younger people compared to their older people, the happiness subscale significantly improved with age. And the anxiety scale and depression scale significantly reduced with age. We are happy. We are not anxious. We are not depressed. As we get older, as we head for age 99. Most people, he says, think that old age
is... You realize you're bucking that curve, right?
What, that I'm depressed?
Well, no, you're not really fitting all that mold. You do realize it, right?
I'm pretty happy.
Doesn't look it.
Inside, I'm happy.
You're making
fun
of people.
On the outside,
I may appear
to be very upset. It makes me happy. Well, let's be honest. People need to be made fun of sometime. Is this all? This is the commentary I'm going to get.
This is it. That's it.
I
refuse to say that word because I am not going to embrace that listener.
And you see, I think our radio fans can see how much happier I am than Rick is right now. It's just right there, night and day.
I can't pick on you, Tony. I like you too much. Apparently, that only goes one direction.
Well, I like you in my way.
I'm always in your way.
In reality, this doom and gloom thing that everything goes downhill does not apply to everybody. Our study of aging adults, they had an improved sense of psychological well-being.
What age in this study constitutes old?
I mean, usually
you know,
what
I'm
I hear
way
is,
younger than you.
Yeah, you are. I'll freely admit that. I admit my impediments.
You don't have any choice but to admit it. I'm being clear on this.
Well, to be honest, I'm older than you.
And that's being very...
The average age is age 66. So these are people that are just right after retirement. Now, retirement itself, of course, it should be a happy time, but it doesn't really matter whether they retire or not. They're still happy. They are still happier as they get older. And you think about this.
We don't know any better.
Well, but this is kind of, the way I look at it is a gift. There was something called, we had this social biology thing where everything that we did was basically evolutionarily driven to try to get our genes into the gene pool. That is, you know, anything we could do, what it means is everything we did was to get women.
Right.
Well, the thing is, I think one of the reasons.
Once we lose that desire.
Well, that's
life
the thing.
Life is better?
There is no evolutionary advantage to old people being happy. As a matter of fact, if you think about it, we old people ought to just wither and die, and let the young people take over. That would be good evolutionarily. But we're hanging on, and we're not only hanging on, we're very happy about it. So you ask yourself, why is it then, why would old people be happy? I think it actually is that. When I was young, I was very, very concerned about women. I wasn't sure I was attracted to women, and I was trying to think of ways to be more attracted to women, and I wanted to show off for women, and I wanted to have all this stuff. And now I don't care.
Now you'll wear a kilt.
I have my limits. But on the other hand, again, back to Dilip Jesty, he says, in all the things we looked at, their level of well-being, happiness, satisfaction with life, the depression, anxiety, perceived stress, and all six of these things, there was an improvement in mental health. It was the people in their 20s and 30s who had the most stress, the highest level of depressive and anxiety symptoms. And I was a mess when I was in my 20s. I absolutely know
Well,
that.
Tony, let's be... See? I'm not going to do it. You can't make me. You can't make me.
Another awkward pause, courtesy of Health Matters.
Actually, what I was going to say.
Mm-hmm. Actually, by the way, is my word for the radio fans that are not aware that I use that all the time.
Yeah, pay attention. He says it a lot.
Okay. And you can write that in on
the problem Facebook is page. Is you say a lot.
Yeah.
Right? So occasionally,
I dilute my actuallys out.
Occasionally, you're going to hit a word over and over and over and can't help it. See, now I don't even know what I was going to say.
Well, we were talking about 20s and 30s were just a bundle of nerves, whereas as you get older.
Well, but what were you doing in those years?
I was in medical school in my 20s.
That doesn't sound stressful.
Well, it was not fun.
You're not exactly the average, 25-year-old or 28-year-old. Right,
but they all are. I mean, if you look right now,
you
Tanner
were
Boyd
stressed
is producing
for different
show.
Reasons.
He is a bundle of nerves.
He's not. He's not even. He doesn't even like you anymore.
I'm just saying, though. You look at. He's the only 20-year-old guy in the room. I think I can safely say that. Let's be honest.
Well, if the truth were known,
really
if the truth were told, right? If the truth were told, can I say that?
Yeah, truth be told, that's fine.
He's not the only 20-year-old in the room.
No.
So you're I'm going to just hang you out there and say you're not even being honest with people.
To which I would reply, okay.
Has this become fun for anybody?
No.
Let's move on.
Okay.
No, Tony.
All right.
Your stress was compounded. You had the stress of medical school and the stress of not knowing if you were ever going to have a woman.
Or be attracted to people. Yeah, sure. I had all those things were in my 20s and 30s. But in fact, it's everyone in their 20s and 30s. It's not just ugly people.
Yeah, but yours was worse. You compounded it with medical school.
With medical school. Perhaps I should have gone to medical school at an older age.
Because you had that whole formaldehyde smell going. I mean, that was you, man.
Back to Dilip Jesty. He says, older people tend to be wiser with age. And I like this guy.
But he did use the word 10.
We need to have him on the show.
He did use 10.
Tend to be wiser
with
age.
He left wiggle room.
They learn not to sweat the little things, and a lot of previously big things become little. A number of studies have shown that older individuals tend to be more skilled at emotional regulation and complex social decision-making. And I do believe, you learn. I've made virtually every mistake that you can make, and so you learn from those mistakes, and I think I am better at it now than I was. But I will say, this is despite the fact, body's deteriorating. I'm certainly, have you ever done this? I look back at those old photographs, and I am intensely embarrassed by the way I looked when I was 10 years younger, but I also wish I still looked that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And especially when I look at myself wearing glasses versus not glasses. I miss the days when my eyesight was 20/10. I totally miss that. I mean, that's something, you get older, and you're right, much happier. There is far more happy in your life. And maybe it's not that there's more happy. I do think it's that there can be less stress. There's opportunity for less stress. Or you've learned how to assimilate or deal with
or
the
maybe
stress.
We're delusional. We talked about that with the Alzheimer's disease. Is it the fact is that you're delusional and you think that you're successful. You're really not. But for whatever reason, it is very comforting to have that happiness.
Very.
I hope that it stays.
So. Yeah, it will. Well, and let's be clear. See, you're doing that, man. I cannot believe
I am
you
loving
named
this show. This is going to go down as the best Health Matters.
You know
ever.
What? After this, we're going to go get your favorite, which is what makes old people happy, and that's ice cream.
Oh,
except
boy.
I'm putting it on your head.
I am loving the ice cream, and I'm loving the radio show. I am just happy right now.
Well, yeah, you get to eat ice cream
day.
At every meal.
And I get to make fun of you pretty much every fractional portion of the show. Which
How
this is really
on earth
well
has that changed from any other show?
Because I got something this time. And you know I do.
I think you're pulling my fingernail back.
I don't know. At any rate, Dylan Jesse says, and this is a nice thing. Like I said, it is a gift. It really doesn't make sense from an evolutionary standpoint why older people would be happy. It is annoying to young people. I mean, you as a young person, you expect to be superior to old people in every way. Old people just need to get out of the way. And here they are, happier than you are. And that probably makes you more upset and you're not able to do anything about it. So at any rate, good news from San Diego. It looks like old people are happy. We sort of knew that. We've seen these studies before. But again, here's a nice cross-sectional thing. Every single scale they looked at, the older people were happier. Now, let's be honest about something else. Let's be honest about cheese. This was in the European Journal of Nutrition. This was in August. And these people came from the Suzhou University, Health Suzhou University. So this is in China. And also the Innovation Center in Inner Mongolia. It's disturbing that Chinese scientists are actually getting good, because now I'm going to have to say some words that I didn't used to have to say, Chinese words. It's called, Suzhou University, colloquially known in Chinese, you might want to know this, as Suda. It's in Jiangsu, China, and I'm sure I just butchered that, but there it is. Now, cheese is bad for you, right, Rick?
Nope.
I mean, you love cheese.
It's one of the major food groups.
Well, there was the dairy thing, I guess. Back in the old, you're going back to your four basic food groups, huh? Wow.
No, I'm going to the fact that I like cheese.
That's interesting. Well, but let me give you some good news, if you will let me. Can I give you some good news? Is that possible?
Zip it.
15 studies that they looked at. Now, these were observational studies, and you know they have problems. But this is the best science we got on cheese. What they did, 15 studies, most of them said, all right, if you have heart disease, you're out. So I can't tell you what you should do about cheese if you have heart disease. Most of the studies follow people for over 10 years. If you ate cheese, high versus low cheese consumption.
And we are going to explain what is high versus low cheese consumption.
We will. We'll sort of hint at it anyway. So 10% lower rates of cardiovascular disease if you were a high cheese person. 14% lower rates of cardiac disease if you were a high cheese person.
Can we just say a cheesy person?
10% lower for stroke if you were a cheesy person. And it looks like what happens is as you increase your cheese consumption, your risk of heart disease goes down, and it sort of bottoms at about 2 slices of cheese a day, 40 grams of cheese a day. And I did some work. My wife helped me out with this, 22 grams or so per slice. So 40 grams a day, 2 slices of cheese a day. And this is not your, you know, Velveeta, your Cheese Whiz or stuff
just
like that.
Just chunk cheese.
This is real cheese, yeah. But 2 slices, the equivalent of 2 slices of cheese a day, had the lowest risk of heart disease. It started to go up after that. But the point is, you know, the idea that you should avoid cheese for your health, we're starting to really look at the evidence, and the evidence is not there. Now, obviously, if you eat a lot of cheese and your weight goes up, that's a problem. If you substitute cheese for vegetables, that's not going to work. But what if you put cheese on the vegetables? 2 slices of cheese or less a day, not a problem, at least in all the studies that we have, and these are observational studies. We'll have to learn more.
But Tony.
And the other thing is they did exclude people who had heart disease at the beginning, so I can't tell you if you have heart disease, this may not apply
to you. So how much milk does it take to make that much cheese? Is this a milk thing, or is this a dairy thing, or is this the fact that we let fungi grow in milk and make cheese?
Right, so the question is, does it do something for your biome?
Right.
The bacteria that are in the cheese, I guess they're bacteria, or the fact that the cheese feeds the right kind of bacteria is one possibility.
Sure.
Or is it the nutrients in the cheese? Or is it just that you could do worse than cheese? Maybe it's not that cheese is good, but if you don't eat cheese, you're going to go and get something worse.
Is it worse if it's on a pizza?
I think cheese on a pizza is probably the one reason I'm not a vegetarian. I'll be honest. I think I could go without.
Well, you can be, but I can't today.
Yeah, I could go without steaks. I don't think I would miss steaks that much, but oh my goodness, pizza, you know, with meat on it, that's pretty darn good. And the cheese really makes the meat pop. All right, let's keep going with the cheese, as a matter of fact. This came from Harvard.
So cheesy.
If you don't like China, this is from Harvard. August 24th, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And they looked at the association between dairy fat and heart disease. So this was not a cheese study, not an observational study. This was dairy fat and heart disease. And what they looked at this in the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study. That's 1986 to 2010. The Nurses Health Study 1 and the Nurses Health Study 2, collectively 1980 through 2011. So these are those long-term follow-ups where you do a questionnaire every year. and then they figure out what happens to you. So the questionnaire, they ask, you know, how much dairy products are you eating? And they had several groups here. They had a high dairy product and a middle and a low dairy product. The risk of heart disease. For a 5% increase in the amount of energy you got from dairy fat, the risk of heart disease is dead even. No different. Risk of coronary heart disease, risk of stroke, no different as you increase your dairy products. You get up to 5%. So we're saying, you know, the observational studies say two slices of cheese may lower your risk slightly. More than that, it starts to go back up. They're saying that in this group of health professionals and nurses, when you look at the risk of heart disease, stroke, and so forth, as you increase your dairy product energy from dairy fat, we don't see any worsening. Well, if you replace animal fats, including dairy fats, with vegetable sources, it may reduce the risk of heart disease. But if you just simply raise the amount of animal fat slightly, no difference.
I'm speechless.
Oh, it's because I've taken away your good findings.
My good nature.
I'm kind of excited about the fact old people are happy, and cheese is not necessarily bad for you if you take it in moderation. That's as nice as we've ever done at Health Matters at giving people some good dietary news.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm a fan of cheese. I definitely think that's great. Now, I'd be curious if there's differences between the various kinds, and so aka can I have a, you know, sharp cheddar all my life, or do I got to stick to some kind of a provolone, or you know, or do I got to stay with a Holy Swiss? I don't know.
They just said cheese. I think you have the ability, as long as you don't go with, you know, Cheese Whiz or some kind of processed cheese. If you have natural cheese, I don't think they separate it out by the type of cheese. You
get whichever Whiz, kind. Tony, you're out of time.
I'm out of time. We're out of time. We're going to take a break and come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Hello and welcome back. I'm not sure I'm up for another third and final fractional portion of Health Matters, but I'm Rick Phillips, and we're going to find out.
And let's be honest, I'm Dr. Tony Weaver.
Bad penny.
The most fun show that I've had in a long time, because I have occasionally caused Rick to actually consider what he is saying before he says it.
All the things you say.
Our sponsor for the final time, let's be honest about why drug prices are so high. Let me run through very quickly the 11 fun facts, and then we'll get to some solutions that are proposed. Again, this came from an article in the AMA Journal, so this is not me talking. This is actually somebody who knows what he's talking about. Fun fact number one, our per capita spending on prescription drugs twice as high as other industrialized nations. Fun fact number two, the state Medicaid programs are spending an estimated $1.1 billion on Sovaldi, the hepatitis C drug. This is without any increase, for the most part, in their spending allotment. So, in fact, it's taking money away from other drugs. Number three, the primary reason for increasing drug spending is the high price of branded drugs. But number four, entrepreneurs have been buying up older companies that have cornered the market on a drug and increasing the price of those drugs by thousands of percent as well. Fun fact number five, drug prices are higher in the U.S. than the rest of the industrialized world because, unlike every other nation, the United States healthcare system allows manufacturers to set their own prices, and no one second-guesses their prices. They set their prices based on, fun fact number six, how much the market will bear. How much will you tolerate your insurance increasing? Number seven, since the advent of the Medicare drug benefit in 2006, the government is now paying for 40% of the nation's total retail prescription drug expenditures and can't negotiate price. Number eight, expensive drugs are rarely important clinical breakthroughs. Many of them are just simply heavily advertised, and it is difficult for the consumer to tell the difference. Number nine, the only form of competition that substantially decreases drug prices is getting generic versions available. Fun fact number 10, entry of generic drugs is often delayed. There are several ways that companies can do this. They can pay the other company not to bring the generic drug to market. Fun fact number 11, in attempting to require formal approval of drugs that were too old to be studied scientifically, the FDA unfortunately created a new industry of doing a very brief study on a drug and then lawyering every generic out of existence and jacking the price, and this is what happened to Colchicine. Now, on to solutions. This is according to the AMA Journal. How do we solve this? One is we got to limit those second secondary patents for trivial changes. These companies will change from a 12-hour formulation to a 16-hour formulation, patent that, advertise it heavily, and they can beat a generic version and keep their patent going. Strategy number two, aggressively police anti-competitive business practices, such as paying other companies not to market a generic drug. We've got to stop that, and we're not being as aggressive as we should. Three, very obviously, enable Medicare and government entities to negotiate price based on how effective the drug is, rather than just simply require them to pay whatever the company charges. Number four, address shortage or pricing problems. Invoke what they call march-in rights. If a company corners the market on a drug, then they have to have some sensible pricing. They can't just simply raise it, such as the EpiPen people did, and also the company that bought Daraprim and increased the price because they had a monopoly. Generic drug policies, greater resources at the FDA for reviewing and approving generic applications so there's not so much delay. And then for healthcare organizations, once again, price negotiation. And this one, actually, Rick, I actually am skeptical about information dissemination. Frankly, the drug companies have so much money that about the only research that's going on now on drugs is coming from the drug companies. And so the information we get to disseminate is very heavily weighted toward proving that their products are superior. There's not an objective agency that is doing this type of comparative drug research. The Obama administration, when they proposed the Affordable Care Act, they said, why don't we have a group that looks at the effectiveness of new technologies? That was called a death panel designed by the government to limit your ability to access health care, and it was taken out of the Affordable Care Act. So right now, there is no agency in the government that is actually looking at the effectiveness of drugs. And so when we disseminate information, it's not good information. That's our sponsor. Let's be honest about why drug prices are so high. And Rick, I will thank you for letting me get up on the soapbox and yell a little bit about those drug prices. That was very kind of you, and I appreciate it.
You know, whenever it comes to talking about drugs, I like to go silent.
Yep.
The drug industry has a way of getting under my skin, right? the whole thing is a mess. And you have to wonder when is the ship going to right itself? I mean, because there are so many things wrong with drug prices. The whole thing is just a mess.
Well, I have spent my life in a highly discriminatory, inequitable healthcare system. Trying to advocate for people, and I'm not trying to be a hero about this. It just happens that if you live in Eastern Kentucky, you're going to advocate for people who don't have access because
right.
that's the nature of the people that I live with and the people I take care of. In asking when will they get right, well, you know, it hasn't my entire life, and it doesn't even headed in the right direction right
but
now.
But that's in a black and white scenario, right? It has been areas of gray the entire time, It's like a teeter-totter. It goes from one side to the other. So sometimes it's closer to the white side of things, sometimes closer to the black side of things. I mean, it never seems to find one of the ends, right? And I don't think it ever will, to be honest. It's too complex, it's too big, and it's too important, and there's too much money to be made off of it.
I think that the fact is that there's too much money to be made off of healthcare.
Well, but the money to be made is because of all those other things, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't go without your drug regimen, right? We've managed to get ourselves on, you know, better, I mean, it's kind of a joke, it's better living through chemistry, right? I mean, you know, that can be applied to different viewpoints. You know, when we were younger, that had a whole different meaning. But as you get older, certainly we have found things that work. I mean, look at the statins. You know, they certainly lower your cholesterol,
yeah.
Right? So it's tough. It's embedded into the perception of a better way or a more healthy life, and that can be very, very, very valuable, and the companies are capitalizing on that.
Well, let's keep going on that. This was Modern Healthcare, August 16th. Aetna pulls out of the Affordable Care Act exchanges, a mass retreat. Aetna has lost more than $300 million on exchanges so far in 2016. So they are pulling back from, it looks like, from down to 242 counties exchanges, down from 778. So they're staying in, but barely. Starting in 2017, Humana will sell plans in only 11 states. They will be down from 1,300 counties to 150 counties on the exchange. They've lost about $400 million in 2016. United Health lost $1 billion over the past 2 years, and they'll stay in a handful of states. Now, the reason they're staying in, understand this, is if they pull out completely, they will be barred from reentering the Affordable Care Act insurance changes for 5 years. So none of these companies wants to be barred from reentering, so they're trying to maintain a token presence. But they make no mistake about it, they are getting out. If you think about the Affordable Care Act, aside from the Republicans...
I try not to.
I know. Well, aside from the fact Republicans have legislated against it, it has had problems. You remember the exchanges, the computer failure.
Right.
When the exchanges launched. They had some nonprofit co-ops that were supposed to offer health insurance to their members, and they collapsed. There was something called the Risk Corridor Program, where the government was going to take care of these startups and reimburse them for losses, and the government didn't fund it, so they just left these groups hanging in bankruptcy. And the key thing, one of the big thing is they've not been able to get young, healthy people to enroll in the Affordable Care Act. A lot of them are sitting on the sidelines, and the penalties are simply not severe enough and not universally applied, so they can stay out. And without them, this thing is getting worse and worse financially. There was an editorial from Uwe Reinhart, who is a healthcare expert, and he says, this is very, very simple. I'm just going to read from a graph that he's got. The bottom 50% of our population accounts for 3% of our healthcare spending. Those are the ones we need. We need their premiums because we're only spending 3% on 50% of the population. Meanwhile, the top 1% accounts by itself for 20% of all spending. So what we did with the Affordable Care Act is we saddled the insurance companies with those top 1%, top 5% people that account for 20% and 50% of all spending, respectively, and we didn't enroll the bottom 50%. And you know, before, the insurance companies were very good. They had the actuaries, they had the mathematicians. They could figure out how much your health care was going to cost, and they could just bar you from getting insurance. They simply wouldn't give you insurance, and that was legal. Well, now they're not allowed to bar you from getting insurance. They can't adjust the rates very much, and they don't have the healthy people signed up. And so they are losing millions, and in the case of United Health, billions of dollars, and they're trying to get out. Meanwhile, the last thing that the Obama administration has to do is to try to make it so that that people are enrolled, enough people are enrolled, that we can take their money and spend it on the top 1% or the top 20% that are using up the healthcare resources. Now, I don't know, Rick. This was something that bothers me. You know, we know that in your last year or your last 2 years of life, the amount of money you spend on healthcare goes up. I don't know if we're going to be in that top 1% or top 20% at some point in our life. Does everyone go through that phase? So, in essence, you are banking money for the time that you will need it. Or, in fact, is there a certain segment of the population and we know both of these things are true, but is it mostly people who have bad health habits and we are all carrying them on our insurance tabs? Or is it the fact that we're all waiting that time when we're going to go into that high spending phase of our lives right before we die?
Well, I mean, if you don't want to go into that high spending cycle or that phase, you could always just live a more risky lifestyle, right? You could go buy a motorcycle and get you a jet ski and go do some hiking on Mount Everest and, you know, possibly do some jumping out of airplanes. I mean, there's all kinds of things, Tony, you could do if you really never really wanted to worry about that phase of your life.
Or the other thing is you could just simply say, all right, when I get to a certain age or if I have a certain illness, I'm going to ask to be made comfortable. The problem is I'm so happy right now, I can't imagine wanting to leave this earth.
But don't you think you'd be happier if you were jumping out of perfectly good airplanes?
No. I have accumulated,
doesn't that just sound fun to you?
I have accumulated wisdom as I've gotten older, and wisdom says, don't jump out of airplanes. That's stupid.
Well, the engine's running.
Again, you look at Tanner Boyd, our producer. I'm sure he would have no qualms about jumping out of an airplane.
I bet he would.
No airplane, says Tanner. Okay, so he's becoming wise more rapidly
but
than some people.
Offer the guy a motorcycle, he's going to take it.
Yeah, okay, sure. But the point is, you know, back to actually being serious about this.
We don't ever, actually. We're never serious.
Never serious, but this is somewhat serious. What are we going to do about our health insurance problems?
Well, you're going to sit around and eat cheese and ice cream.
And I'm going to enjoy myself and probably not increase my risk of heart disease measurably by doing that in moderation. You're going to go with an all-meat pizza.
Absolutely.
I will have
when
peppers
on my
pizza.
The mortician will not have to drag the smile onto my face. All right? There won't be any
Rick looks natural. He looks like he just had a pizza.
And I want you to say that at my funeral.
At your funeral, if I'm in charge of your eulogy, I'll be honest. I will be honest.
You're going to start the eulogy out with that?
Let's be honest. Rick looks like he's a very happy guy right now. Once again, back to what we're talking about. Reinhart, the AMA Journal, August 25th. He says, here's our problem, and this is why the Affordable Care Act is in jeopardy. Health insurers did something very unnatural. It forced them to knowingly issue policies to very ill at premiums that were far below the claims that they knew they were going to get. Now, they did this, despite their actuaries protesting, they did this because the federal government assured them of two things. One, we'll get everybody to sign up. And two, is if things go bad, we will help you out. The federal government did neither of these things. And so in this case, this is not the Republicans litigating this thing. Maybe it is because they were able to change some of the terms. But this is, in fact, the government is abandoning these insurance companies after they said. And I find it's a strange thing when I'm defending insurance companies. But they were forced into something they knew was not profitable. They bankrolled a lot of money. They diversified. They prepared for it. And it turned out far worse than they thought.
Yep.
So now they are minimizing their footprint in the Affordable Care Act exchanges. They're going to still, and I think this is going to actually keep, and I said actually again, I realize that, this is going to actually keep employer-based insurance.
So you said it twice there.
I know. It's going to keep employer-based insurance alive because the exchanges are too risky. But if you're Aetna, if you're Humana, if you're United Health, you will gladly go into an employer and quote them a price for insurance for their employees because you know what you're getting into.
Right. That healthy workforce.
That's where you want to make your money.
Right. Has some premiums that aren't going to necessarily turn into hospital stays.
Right. Read you the last sentence from Reinhart's editorial, something that really got me. The problem is our health system is in danger of pricing kindness out of our souls. What he says is, look, in the United States, our healthcare system is structured to yield prices for healthcare products and services twice as high or more as identical items in other countries, driving U.S. per capita healthcare spending twice as high as in other countries. The fact that it is so much more expensive in the U.S. than other countries to provide healthcare to all means that we can't provide healthcare to all, especially people who are ill and poor. If we want to pay, and I'm including myself, if we want to pay our doctors what we're paying them, if we want to pay our healthcare executives what we're paying them, we want to pay the insurance people, the stockholders, and these companies, what we're paying them, there is no system in the world, no matter how well designed, that will allow that. Somebody has to lower their prices.
So you left out the equipment manufacturer. So it's okay to pay $3 million for an MRI and have 70 of them in the state of Kentucky?
I see.
Or 120? I mean, so, you know, Tony, you're a doctor. I'm married to a doctor. I hate picking on doctors because, you know, you can always point the doctor and say they make too much money. But there are other areas in the healthcare that have not near the risk that a doctor takes on every single day and still cost, you know, infinite amounts of money in comparison. So I look at should we be paying? Because what we're saying is those equipment manufacturers are charging us. They're charging us for the R&D of the equipment, and they're charging us for the medical malpractice and litigation that's going to happen for the life of that piece of equipment, right, across their entire product portfolio. So you're paying that CT van manufacturer for all the lawsuits they're going to get too.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of problems with healthcare. I am never going to step up to the plate and say it's the doctor's fault.
No.
They're only a small fraction of the money that goes out in the healthcare system.
But I think across the board, we can't afford any of this. And it is ridiculous to continue to pretend that we can.
Right.
When we can.
Let's regulate the fact that we can without looking at the finances of what's going to work.
And now we're going to regulate health matters right off the air.
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Tanner Boyd and to Eric Bilby, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org. Or do a search on Facebook, just look for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters announces today that we will launch our first generic Health Matters radio show at a list price of $300 per show, which represents a discount of more than 50% to our list price of the branded show. This generic radio show was inspired by the makers of EpiPens, who announced a generic version of their product last week.
Health Matters co-medical host Rick Phillips commented, "We understand the deep frustration and concerns associated with the cost of Health Matters and have always shared the public's desire to ensure that this important radio show be accessible to anyone who needs it. Our decision to launch a generic alternative is an extraordinary commercial response. Because of the complexity and opaqueness of today's branded radio show supply chain, we determined that bypassing the brand system in this case and offering an additional alternative was the best option. Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week as Health Matters prepares for our Senate subcommittee testimony on price gouging on Morehead State Public Radio."